Sports Pick Podcast, Picks and Perspective with Chris Johnson.
Nice.
Paradox.
Oh man, what's up?
Dude, everything's up, I guess. You know, so many things in a lot of ways. But how are you? It's what, almost 5:30 in Serbia?
Yeah, 5:30, 5:25 exactly. Yeah.
Cool. How was your day so far?
It's been a weird day, honestly.
Because, really?
Yeah. So it was, first of all, the weather is completely messed up. So this morning I was walking outside in my t-shirt, actually with my jacket, but like unzipped. It was like nice weather. A few hours later, snow.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
No, yeah. And in the meantime, I found a stray dog outside, and for whatever reason, I got really attached to it. And I was just, you know, messaging everyone I know who's got any kind of connection with like dog shelters or like just people who maybe want to take her. And then when the snow started falling, I ran out, I was looking for her, and then I found her in some, it's like a nearby building. Some children were just tucking her in and giving her some water. So she was fine, I guess. And yeah, I'm waiting. I've posted some stuff on my social media and I'm waiting for people to, you know, say something, I guess, to see if, yeah,
see if somebody can take the dog or.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh man, that's very kind of you. I'm yes. Also obviously a fellow dog lover. It's one of my favorite things. I love seeing your dog photos of your dog.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I mean, you know how it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm so attached to my dog, to Kimsey. Like it's at the point now she just turned 7 years old, and we've been together since she was about 7 months. Yeah. And I mean, I don't talk to anybody as much as I talk to my dog, you know,
exactly.
Like I just don't. And she knows all the secrets, you know, she knows everything, and yeah, like good and bad. And she's been a really interesting, it's like a scenario where sometimes I feel crazy for like, I'm talking to a dog, you know, yeah. But at the other end of it, I actually feel so thankful for having the dog, especially since I don't have a primary partner during this COVID and all this stuff, that it has been just miraculous to be able to wake up with her every day. And she keeps me, sane and thinking about the things that are most important, you know, like it's time to go for a walk. Simple. You're right. It's time to go for a walk. Let's go for a walk. It's time to eat. It's time to eat. Oh, it's time to play. And she does these, you know, these little simple reminders. She's goofy and she's learned so many words of mine now that like, and little mannerisms and stuff. She can sense my energy when we're about to go do something or she thinks I'm going to go do something. So
yeah, they learn that stuff. It's incredible. Yeah,
it really, really, really is. Yeah, man, it's been a while. We haven't been able to, we haven't caught up in a while. So I'm really thankful for you taking the time and jumping on here with me. This is cool.
Anytime. Anytime. Yeah, it's been a while.
Like last time we hung out, it was NAMM year, you know, last year, right? And
January. Yeah.
When we had no idea that this
no
was coming.
No idea. No clue. Yeah.
We're just like, see you next NAMM, David.
Yeah, like a normal thing. But no, doesn't happen like that, I guess. Not anymore.
No, but in some weird ways, right? It's really, you can't shake the death toll of the scenario. But it has made me, and I think maybe a lot of us probably look at, because things have strangely improved for a lot of us. That have weathered the storm, and so, you know, there's still a lot of things that aren't great about the scenario, but I know a lot of people that have kind of gotten relief from their day-to-day jobs. They've found out that they can work from home. They've found out other ways to make money and be active. And how's it working for you?
It definitely puts something into perspective, I think. I don't know. I've missed out on a bunch of things in the last 10 years, I feel like, you know.
Like, how so?
So business-wise, I've had like mid last year, I've had like Pliny, I had Liam, who is our tour agent, I had Raul, who is both of ours internet marketing guy. All three of them were just bashing the shit out of me for not doing the work properly. Because I don't know. I just, you know, I never really cared about, you know, just making CDs and books and all that type stuff. I was just like writing, releasing. Like, that's the only thing I ever wanted to do, which it is. And then they were just giving me shit for some time. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. And then I spent most of the last year. I did remasters for Belows. I did, you know, just like all the tab books for all the records, and then the design, the new designs and all that stuff. So I'm like, you know, chasing some vinyl records printing places right now. And then I'm going to chase some, you know, somewhere to print all my tab books because there's a bunch of them now. So it's, you know, I've been doing mostly that. I've kind of put Below 4 on the sides just to, you know, finish everything I didn't finish in the last, you know, 10 years. And this year is 10 year anniversary since Below 1. So,
oh, wow.
It's like, yeah.
So that's, it kind of makes up sense.
Yeah. Definitely snuck up. So, yeah, it kind of makes sense to give Below more appreciation in that way, I guess. So yeah, that gave me, you know, I just kind of spent most of my time just doing that. And the other things that put into perspective is I don't want to live in the city anymore.
Mm.
That's for sure. So Jelka and I, we've been looking for some places outside Belgrade. So we'll see how that goes. We'll see. I think by the end of the year, we might move. And yeah, there's a couple of towns that we have in mind.
Cool. Really
nice. Yeah.
Definitely encourage that. I mean, I had my own feeling around that when all this happened. You know, I was still in LA, and
that's right. Yeah.
I hung out for a couple of months, and I mean, LA was already very not my style. I mean, I love visiting there. I love being there and being creative with people and working there. It's like, because so many people are there. And when you go there, it's like, oh, wow, we have all this opportunity. Let's go over here and do a session, be with these people and go over there and do that. It's dense, you know, with opportunities. Yeah. But for an ongoing living situation, you have to be a certain kind of person. And I moved back home to like 7 hours north. So even though it's a little town, it's like we have 120,000 and 150,000 when the college is in session or something here, which is still big enough to have all the things, but very close to nature all the time. Like
nice.
5-10 minute drive, you know, and I'm in the canyon, and I don't even know. Barely can feel like the city or the anything. It's just
nice.
And that's been everything. I can see that you go out into nature a lot too, so I imagine
a lot.
You would prefer to be closer to it, right?
Absolutely. Man, there's this like it's not even a mountain, I guess it's a mountain because it's like above 600 meters high, but it's like 1 hour drive for me, even less. And I've been just going there every week. I was just dragging people there, friends, Jelka, my dad, like we were just going there, taking walks. There's like a bunch of little waterfalls there. It's really nice. and I've never been there before. It's like, it's insane. I'm like, this is just like 55 minute drive and I can just enjoy all this.
Yeah,
that's really important, I think. Yeah.
What do you feel like you get out of your time in nature?
Ooh, peace. The insane thing happens every time. Like on my way there, I need to listen to music or a podcast or something. I spend a few hours there, and on my way back, I just want silence. Mm. I just want silence, and my thoughts are so collected. It's mind-blowing, honestly. It's really cool. Yeah.
I love hearing that.
I love it.
It's one of the things that I admire about your approach. I know that your peers say that you're a little unconventional, right? Because you're not, it's taken you a while to catch up on some of these things. But I think the way you see, the way you speak, the way you play, all those things are representative in your valuing of space, and you seem to value and put value on space in your music and in the way you speak and everything. So it doesn't surprise me to hear you say that and be like, oh, once I experience that space and that peace, I want to keep it going for a while. bring it home with me if I can, you know?
Definitely.
Yeah.
And I know you have a bunch of walks with your dog at the ocean side.
Yeah.
Are you still near the ocean?
We're a little further from the ocean now. We're roughly 3.5 hours from the ocean. So I haven't been driving out there that much, but I have a plan next month to head down there to record some yoga instructional videos. Nice. And we'll definitely go to the ocean. We have our favorite beach there. Now we're more Central Valley, North Central Valley of California. Mm. So about an hour and a half of north of Sacramento. And so it's hotter here during the summer. It's like mega hot during the summer, and we have lots of fire issues.
All right.
Most of California does now at this point, but we have a canyon, and there's this, I guess it's called Little Chico Creek or Chico Creek, but it's snow melts predominantly through the year from Mount Lassen, which is an old volcano. And the whole canyon coming down is all full of old volcanic rock, just ancient volcanic rock. And
that's cool.
These huge walls, and the water is so clean and pure and cold most of the time. So when it gets really hot, you want to be in that water. And it develops all these natural swimming holes that I've been going to since I was, in my mid to late teens, and it doesn't get old to me. It's like I'll go out and walk in this area every day or every other day, and at least like the first part of it. I don't get too deep into the canyon every day, but it just revives me in a way that, like, you're kind of explaining, like you get this sense of peace, and to experience wide open spaces is just so important. Especially in the time when we're closed in a lot, I gotta stay in. Be careful. Okay. Now I'm out in this wide open space. Wait, I don't have to wear a mask. I don't have to do any of these things. I can just breathe freely,
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense, man. I mean, I know so many people who just want to move away from the city at this point. And I know a few who actually, they've already made the move. For me, I just want to wrap up things that I started here. And then Yelke and I, we are going to make some moves for sure.
Because nice.
I guess only now we realize like how much less sense it has to live in such a crowded place. It's kind of crazy. And we have nothing holding us here. And I'm pretty sure you know the feeling. You work for Kiesel, so yeah.
Yeah, it's that. Well, and that has been the reason why I've stayed where I've stayed for the last decade, was because I was tied to an office. I had to be in the office, working at the office. And there's a certain amount of stress around the, I'm really glad that we're starting to evolve. At least it feels like this thing is going to shift us to being able to be more free with our work, right? It may not be as kinesthetic or as synergistic in some ways, because you're sitting at a desk and everybody is down the hallway and you can't just walk down there and be like, hey, I got an idea. You have to Zoom somebody, you have to email somebody. But the flip side is that you probably have to learn, you know, you're up, your communication has to go up. You have to get better at communicating through those avenues. Be clearer with your words, clearer with your ideas, and then letting people make their schedule more and work in hours that suit them and be able to be flexible. You know, what a great idea, and potentially be closer to other friends and family and nature. You know,
that as well. Yeah. Seems like a logical move. At the moment, at least. I don't know. The thing is, Serbia has been pretty relaxed with all the COVID measures.
Oh, really? Like,
we haven't had a lockdown since April last year.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Everything's been pretty much open. We don't have, like, nightclubs working. We don't have concerts, rarely, only when the numbers go below, like, 100 people a day or something like that. But yeah, everything pretty much works. We don't have to wear masks outside at all, only if you're in the shop or something like that. So it's been pretty relaxed, and still we feel like, you know, like it's a bit much living in the in the city. And Belgrade is a city of, I believe, 2 million people, something like that.
Wow.
So it's not small.
No, not at all.
It's pretty dense as well. It's pretty dense. So it's, you know, it's feeling a little wary, I guess. Especially the traffic. So
Yeah.
We'll
don't see. Miss the traffic of the city, man. Neither the Bay Area or LA, man. Just like that was the like everybody in LA is like, oh man, it's 20 minutes away. So and then you just do the math. You're like, that means it could take 2 hours. Like,
yeah,
it should be 20 minutes, but it could most likely, depending if it's not like in a rare little pocket of the day, then it's going to be an hour, you know, maybe two, depending on where you're going, but so dense.
Also, you know, LA is so huge. It's insanely huge. Like, from one side of LA to go to another side of LA is like going between two biggest cities here in Serbia, pretty much.
Sure. Yeah.
it's pretty insane.
It's massive. Yeah. That's, and with that comes a lot of, you know, again, a lot of opportunity, but also a lot of potential for, you know, I guess, you know, I hate to be like dystopian, but like, I'm not like looking forward to a major catastrophe happening in one of our major cities, you know, like, and I don't want to be there like when it happens, if I can help it, you know, an earthquake that, you know,
California is pretty much overdue, long overdue for an earthquake. Is that true? Is that like,
it's correct? Yeah, it seems correct. But when we say overdue, it seems as though we could be overdue and it's like about to happen in 50 years and in 100 years. It could be past our lifetimes that, you know, in a geologic, you know, being ready, you know, like it could be ready in the next 1,000 years, you know, I don't know. But I do, because we haven't had anything major since probably the Bay Area. I mean, we've had a couple of shakers that did do some damage, but the one that happened, I think in 88 or 89 or something like that, that like collapsed the Bay Bridge. And like, I mean, it was a massive thing. That we haven't had anything quite like that since then. So it's been, you know, quite a while. Hopefully that being due for it is far out.
Yeah.
Cause I just, you know, there's just so much heartache in the world already. And to, you know,
imagine
just a,
that
just
shit.
A deal. Yeah.
Imagine that on top of all this.
Yeah. That's what I'm like. And I hate having the imagination that can fathom it in a way, because like, then
yeah,
I'm like, what am I doing even thinking about this? Stop thinking
insane
about this. Don't bring this into light. You know, you don't need to, you know, but there's an element of being realistic, you know, mm-hmm. around it. Like the possibility is there.
Yeah.
Without trying to give it too much energy or too much, you know, platform to happen, I guess. But you know, the world is a living creature, so to speak, and so it can awaken and do what it needs to do and shift as it pleases. So we're just lucky to be here in this little moment of time, you know.
Fuck, man, when you start having those thoughts, like, okay, mm-hmm. I'm gonna be here for the next 60 years if I'm lucky. That's gonna be 90 years for me. So it's like, what is 60 years? Nothing.
Nothing.
Like, what was Nothing. 60 years ago? What was 60 years ago? Was 1960? So 60s, I guess. Yeah.
Sure.
Vietnam was in 60s.
Yeah, a lot has happened, you know, and that, and it's a short window for the world, but a huge, like, we're so exponential in the way that we work, you know.
Yeah,
with wars, with technology, the whole deal.
Fuck.
yeah. When I go down that road, I'm like, why am I doing any of this stuff that I'm doing? What I mean is does it matter? Because if you even start expanding from there, you're like, well, eventually the sun will explode and there won't be an Instagram, you know, like post left for us to be remembered by, you know, there won't be a Facebook update that is saved, you know, you know, there's no tweets that are going to be, that are going to make it through the sun exploding, you know? So like, because I hear a lot of artists, they're like, oh man, well, at least I'll, you know, for my legacy, I'm going to leave this for my legacy. Like, this is how I'll be known when I'm gone.
Yeah.
For what? For I hear you. And that's a romantic idea, but it's also like, you know, even if you're the biggest artist on the planet, even if you're Eddie Van Halen, you know, or Michael Jackson or any of these, you know, any household name, like when the earth is scorched, like no one will know, there'll be no one to. So in that realization, it's like, well, what is my purpose? Why am I doing the things that I'm doing?
Yeah, it can be scary. Those thoughts can be pretty, pretty bad and pretty good at the same time. Pretty bad and pretty good. Do we ever think about, are we going to start the podcast, or do you want to?
Oh, this is it, man.
This is the podcast.
Oh man, we're okay. In. Yeah. Yeah. It's a rolling start with me, man.
Because I was thinking like, oh, we started talking about all the stuff. Like, what are we going to talk about in the podcast, I guess. What were we talking about? Jesus.
The sun exploding and nothing being worth
That's
anything.
Right. Do you often think about that?
I mean, fairly often, more often than maybe the average person. And I only say that because it's like, it helps me to decide what's important. And I think ultimately, you know, like being creative, man, it fills me with so much joy, and I really love it. And I feel like an honor it is to have the opportunity and the privilege to be in a place of being creative in this life, in this world, amongst a lot of other people that aren't as privileged or have those opportunities. And because I feel like I've woken up to see myself somewhat straightforwardly, mm-hmm. and what it is that I have to offer, and knowing that that no amount of money, no amount of acquisition of material goods will make me happy or sustain any type of joy. So I have found that like it's the passing moment. It's the expanded now that is the most important. And the relationship with other human beings, the other aspects of myself, which I consider everyone another aspect of myself. It's kind of my personal philosophy. I go, well, oh, David's the part of me that does the thing that this part of me doesn't do, right? He does all the stuff that I don't know how to do. And he says the things and we're all kind of, I'm the part of you that does the things that I do that you don't, this lifetime isn't really suited for you. You know, I'll do those other things and that's fine. Like yeah. Somebody else has got it. And trying to be in relationship in a kind of a pure way, and be of service somehow, while recognizing that this ego is still important and still like standing up for yourself and being exactly who you are is totally fine too. It's not like you have to like get rid of ego completely and go into a cave and meditate, but it's helped me when things come to push or shove, so to speak. I knowing the sun's going to explode and none of this will matter someday, I realize, oh, well, it matters right now to this person, to that dog this morning, David. It fucking matters.
Oh yeah.
Right? It fucking matters. And I think that's the best I got for that.
Yeah, nice. I love that. Yeah. Lalic was at my place last night or the night before. And we always touch on some really weird subjects. I mean, weird if you're, you know, comparing them to conventional subjects, but like, just like philosophies and all that stuff. And he often thinks about death and he's very scared of that nothingness that it brings. Because that's, I guess, how he imagines it, like one big nothing. And how, I mean, that's what he has the issue with imagining, I guess, imagining. And it makes sense. It's something I struggle with. Like, what is nothing? Like, how does nothing feels like? Obviously, like nothing, but how do you describe that nothing? And then we just go into the woods with those kind of talks for a while. And I don't know, he's such a good guy to talk with, because even though he agrees with you 100%, he will always try and find a different angle just to see how you're going to respond, or just to stir some cages, I guess. That's the saying. So yeah, I love it. Yeah.
What do you think? I mean, what is your intuition around the passing of this physical flesh?
I don't know, man. I rarely think about that. Very rarely. I could almost say almost never. I also spoke with Jelka about all this recently, because I guess we are losing so many people these days to the pandemic and all that. And a bunch of celebrities died like at the finish line. Like, we got all the vaccines. It was everything ready. Like, there was like more than a million people vaccinated. And all of a sudden you hear a bunch of well-known people here just dying.
Wow.
And you're like, why? Like, everybody got so relaxed because we were at one point, I guess we were even like the most successful country in Europe with vaccinations. So everyone were like, oh, job done. And now we have like I hope this is going to be the last really strong wave, and it's pretty strong with COVID. And it's probably going to go. But yeah, to go back to the subject of death, Jelka and I, we talked about it, and I guess we have the same feeling about it. We share the same feeling about it. And that is, we often think about death of our loved ones than our own death.
Mm.
Both of us. While we also know people who are close to us who often think about their own death and are not so worried about the death of loved ones, which doesn't make them bad or good, or doesn't make us bad or good. It's just a different perspective on death itself, I think. Not like, I don't care about others. Like, they can die. I'm going to die. That's what matters. Yeah, I don't know why. I just never think about my own death. It's as if I don't really care about it. And I don't even think it has much to do with your, like, childhoods or anything like that. I think it's just a feeling that you're born with for some reason, because we know so many people who have had like similar experiences to us, with us, like us. Mm. We all grew up in the same country, was torn by a civil war, and then there was a like a, this whole thing with that region, Kosovo, at the south of Serbia, and then we were bombed, and then there was a revolution, and then like there was the how do you call that in English, attentat, like killing of a important person, of a police
assassination,
right?
Mm.
Assassination of our prime minister, who really started moving the country forward, and then like it was just non-stop, you know, something. Wow. From about when we were children or when we were born until, I mean, pretty much recently. So it's not like we share different experiences, and like as if like that war left some trauma on us and we are like worried about one thing rather than the other. It's just, I don't know what shapes that feeling, honestly, but it's definitely interesting.
I don't know that it's a bad thing that you don't think about your death, actually. I mean not that it would be bad either way, but in some ways I think it to be more zen if you can, if you're blessed with not thinking about it too much. And I'm thankful mm-hmm. that I don't obsess over it. Yeah. But when someone does pass around me, and I just had somebody pass a few days ago, and it's been interesting processing that.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, thank you, man. It was, so my brother and I, we have the same dad but different mom, mm-hmm. and his mom passed away, and she, you know, she and I weren't super close or anything, but like we have lots of memories from being young, and you know, me and my brother getting into trouble and like just being kids, you know, and knowing enough about her through the years and how much she cared for her kids and everything. And more so, it's more so about my love and my compassion for my brother, seeing my brother be in pain, you know, and feel the loss around it. And
is he younger than you?
A couple years. Yeah, just a couple years younger than me. And we're in our 40s. I'm 44. He's 42. And it's just one of those things where it makes you contemplate the absence. And I think it's like, I don't know if you're familiar with Zen koans, right? Like the word koan. It's no. K-O-A-N, koan, mm-hmm. and it's a thing that Zen masters through millennia it's like a parable or a riddle, so to speak, that's unsolvable, that the master gives to the student to have them, because they can't be solved with logic, is mm-hmm. the key, right? It has to be solved with a certain amount of spontaneity and intuition. And even then, the answer is not the same each time. When an answer, when, if a master gave us both the same koan, we couldn't give the same answer. It's not, it wouldn't be allowed, right? Because then, because especially if I heard your answer and then I tried to answer after that, and give the same answer, he'd be like, oh, it's contrived, right? Like, yeah. don't give me the same answer. That's not, that's his answer.
Yeah.
And he came to that through spontaneity. So I bring that up because I think the contemplation of nothingness and, you know, it is like the ultimate koan. It's like the, it's like the ultimate universe going, here, chew on this, buddy. You're here now. You're here now. That's interesting, right? Woo. But you won't always
think about,
you won't always be, you won't, this body works today.
Yeah.
But tomorrow, you, at some point you're going to see the degradation of your skills, your ability to move in the world, your ability to be cognitive, all that stuff will eventually decline on some, at some level and disappear. So it just puts me in an interesting, I do grieve when somebody passes, that's for sure. Like it's been interesting to grieve somebody that I actually wasn't even super close to, you know, like, and I'm also pretty easy crier anyway. So like, I might have cried when Robin Williams died. I was like, dude, this sucks. You know, like, it's one of my favorite people, but yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. You know, that also kind of puts things into perspective, the koan thing. How much of your I want to say day-to-day life, but also how much of your pretty much like life philosophy comes from yoga and Buddhism? I guess there's a bunch of that implemented.
Yeah, much of it, I would say. You know, maybe the entirety of it in some ways, because there's all these aspects of Buddhism and yoga, Hinduism and Eastern philosophy that that seem on the surface to be similar to other religions or and have dogma attached to them, but really most of the East is an open source system. It's like, it's not saying, oh, this is the way you got to do it or you're going to hell. It doesn't, there's like very little of that. It, in fact, maybe none of it really, truly. And it's part of my attraction to it is that I'm like, oh, look, it's every man for himself. It's every, and you've got to sort out your own salvation. You've got to sort out your own joy. Like there's no ready-made thing. There's no turnkey operation available. Not really, you know, not when you get down to it, but that's what more Western, you know, Western Christianity and all of its offshoots kind of seem to offer. They say, hey, just show up on Sundays. We got you. You know, put some money in the tithe plate, you know, help me pay for my private jet. And, you know, and God will forgive you for your transgressions. And I'm raised very Christian, so I still have I still study a reasonable amount. And I'm one of those odd birds, I guess, that at nighttime, I mean, sometimes I watch movies and I do love like funny stoner stuff because I'm totally stoner, but I often am always deep diving on YouTube for all these like religious breakdowns. I love listening to Jewish rabbis talk about, they're so smart. I love hearing them talk about how Christianity is like Mormon, what Mormonism is to Christianity. And like, they break all this stuff like, hey, you guys just grabbed our book and started talking about it and made up all these extra stories. We didn't sign off on it, man. That sequel wasn't authorized. and just listening to different people, you know, and trying to understand perspective from people around the world. Yeah. It's interesting to me.
Same. I recently started following this Muslim dude on YouTube. I don't know, but by accident, like I clicked on one video and then he just started coming up again and again. I watched maybe 4 or 5 videos of his, and you know, although I don't obviously agree with some of the stuff, like he's debating gay dudes, he's debating you know, Christians, atheists, just trying to, you know, maybe find common ground and find the differences as well. He's a pretty young dude. I don't know how old is he, but as far as I understood, he finished political science and history, something like that. And he's also devout Muslim.
Wow.
And his YouTube channel is pretty much about that. So it's been just interesting to see the perspective, because I honestly don't know much about Islam, and to hear him speak about Quran and, you know, all that, it's just, it's been pretty interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a fan of that, you know, checking in, even if I don't agree with it. Right. Like, I think that's what you're getting at. Right.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I love it. Especially when I don't agree, I would be like just listening and trying to understand, you know, where that comes from, be, you know, religious stuff or, you know, political stuff or, you know, just like life stance on whatever subject. It's really interesting to just see what people think. It's really cool.
I think in that same avenue is like when somebody is so sure of themselves about something, like they're just, no, this is happening, this is, and it's nothing that can be proven, it's just, it's like some old books said some stuff and we kept talking about that old stuff and those old books and these people, and it's been passed down, it's tradition, and I'm sure of it. I'm like, oh, tell me more, because I'm not so sure of anything like that.
Yeah,
you know, like I don't have the like, I mean, occasionally there have been times in my life where I felt like, and because I came from a Christian background, I definitely had moments as a kid where I got indoctrinated. I was indoctrinated into, and I had that turnkey mechanism in me where I'm like, hey, just come in. Like it's, you can, this is the, all the answers are here.
Right.
But that's something that happens in our youth. That's something, you know, I call it the born again Christian kind of syndrome. It's like when you get super hyped on something and you want everybody to be in your group, you're like, yo, dude, you got to try this. You got to try this. You got, no, YouTube, come on, everybody. And everybody's like, okay, maybe, you know, like it's like knocking doors and proselytizing. I don't know how to say that word, but preaching.
I don't even know what it means.
I have no idea.
Good for you not knowing how to say it.
Yeah, it's kind of preaching your thing. I don't know, but some words, you know, whatever.
Words. Yeah, but since you mentioned the Eastern philosophy and how open it is to death, in a sense of like, we don't give you a solution, you figure it out. Pretty much, I feel like Orthodox Christianity, which is the kind of Christianity I grew up in, is the same. There's no going to church on Sundays. You go whenever you want to go. It's pretty much that. Like, you have to take care of your own shit and God help you.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah. Just have faith and maybe you'll do easier, I guess.
I can get along with that. It's usually the expanded, either early versions or the more esoteric versions of the religions of the faiths around the world. Like, if you look at like early Gnostics and like the Cathars, and there's a whole different like sect of Christianity that was on the side, that the mainstream Christianity that was backed by the state and by the kings end up crushing. And those smaller beliefs had more of the kind of like open-ended, like, you know, you have to do the thing. No one's going to save you necessarily. And they were, because they were closer to the Eastern religions, I think, you know, the Zoroastrianism and different things that were kind of all influenced into Christianity, eventually some of it. And but it's when man, you know, and the kings and the state wanted to use that power that religion had over the people to keep them in fear, that it becomes like, oh, well, yeah, I'm not really.
It morphs into some stuff.
Yeah. And I feel like we're still at the effect of that in a lot of ways, because there's so much, at least in, you know, certain countries, in our country, it's a weird thing. We say separation of church and state, but, you know, that every politician seems to have to like be Christian, you know, like to like have street cred, you know, and get voter turnout. It's weird.
God bless America.
So, yeah, right there. It's like just us, not you guys, not Serbia. Sorry. Sorry. Did Jesus come to Serbia? I don't think so. I don't.
Not
think
really.
So.
No.
Wait, Jesus come to America?
He was a big fan of LA.
Yeah. Well, the Mormons would tell you. I think they say yes. I think the Mormons say something about.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I know nothing about Mormonism, honestly.
It's super funny in that all you have to do, I think, is watch some South Park.
All right, yes.
South Park does some cool breakdowns, but they, you know, they basically, there was a guy that said that he went into a cave or found some golden tablets that nobody ever saw, and that was able to. Yeah. And then there was like a point where like the person that took down the first time he did it, like where he recited what was on the tablets and somebody wrote it down, that those pages were lost. And then they had to do it again, and it wasn't the same. And there's a bunch of little, you know, it's just humans being humans, I guess. So
yeah, I guess it's a really cool story that found its place in humanity in a weird way.
Yeah. And I think all of it, in a lot of ways, it, you know, especially when there's an outside, when we look outside ourselves for confirmation that we're going to be okay and that somebody else is going to save us. You know, I think that all the religions in some ways are just speaking to our innate insecurity. Like we're looking to secure our place in the world somehow, and to go, okay, it's not all chaos, it's not all craziness, I can bet on this. And it makes my nervous system maybe come down a bit, because I know that I've got some sort of answer. But really, when you look up in the sky, like these meteors and planets and stuff, any of that stuff, it seems like random explosions. It's very, you know, very chance, you know, so we rather try to make some sort of sense of it. Yeah. But, and I think we want, you know, as adults too, like we get indoctrinated into it. And then like, it's like the rest of our life, using a lot of times using the religion as like mommy and daddy, you know, using God as some sort of parent situation. Because we didn't get it or whatever. But
yeah,
wow, light conversation with David Maxim in the morning.
Started off light, yeah. we went deep into it like straight away.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's what this thing, it's what this podcast is actually supposed to be kind of about. It's supposed to be able to go in any direction, you know, and just have good conversations with people.
That's nice. That's good.
Well, I'm curious about how the guitars are treating you. You got a couple of guitars, and
I love them absolutely. Yeah. I've been especially playing the 7-string headless Black Link. The Zeus, yes.
Yeah.
I still need to remember the names. Like when someone asks me, just be like Zeus. Delos. Yeah, Zeus. I love it. It's very comfortable. I haven't played much headless guitars before, so it's a new avenue for me. And there was actually some getting used to the headless guitar. especially with the vibrato, because there's no weight that head gives, I guess. It just feels a little off at the start, at least. Now I'm pretty much used to it, but at the start, like, especially when switching quickly between the two, I just feel like a little bit of weight missing on that side. And it's just like, I have to do more, I guess.
Sure.
I don't know with which part of my body and how, but it's just like, it's been a little thing to get over, I guess, but I absolutely love it. It's really fun. And just carrying it around, like between my workspace and my living place, it's been just like, just put it there and whenever I feel like. Yeah, absolutely love it. Really cool.
I love the diminutive size.
Yeah.
The way it brings the guitar in, it feels like less obtrusive somehow, you know, less like in the way, even though it is, you know, like you said, a little different. You have to kind of adjust a little bit.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. What about your guitars? You get guitars all the time.
I do. I do. I have. I'm blessed. I got this. I have to show off this thing because this is the guitar I had built for Kimsey.
Nice.
Put the paw print there. The 12 fret.
That's really cool. Is that his paw? She's her paw?
No, it's actually Jeff Kiesel's dog that just passed away a little while ago. Her name was Leia.
Okay, and I heard about that. Yeah.
So he made the Leia model, and then he introduced the paw print at the 12th fret, which was her paw print, and she was a boxer, and Kimsey's a boxer pit bull. So look at the back; it was like the crazy crackle. It's got pink and purple in there, and the purple heart neck, the walnut.
Nuts.
The only eight string I have, and I wanted to make an eight string that was interesting to me because I feel like I feel like it's like not an instrument that I'm comfortable with at all. You know, like I'm like, oh, just make it really cool looking and make it, I'll attach it to my dog and then I'll want to play it because, you know, but if it's just an eight string, just to have an eight string around, like I won't want to play it.
Yeah.
It's not exciting, but this has been really exciting.
That's like the wildest 80s type finish.
It is.
Yeah.
To
put that on the eight string, I think it's really cool, actually. It was just like a regular six string, I would be like, cool guitar, whatever. But this way, it's actually kind of cool. I like
that. Yeah, kind of mixing the vibes, right? You know? And what's interesting, I didn't expect it, was because I got this one recently too, and I really love this guitar as well. This is a seven string Delos.
That's nice.
And this particular build off of a bass that I did for Erica Badu's bass player, Braylon Lacey. He ordered a J bass that had this Olympic white with the red tortoiseshell pick guard, and I was like, oh man, in the rosewood board, I was like, yeah, I kind of want that on a
nice
on a guitar. And I got this and I love it. It's great. I'm still making friends with this particular guitar. But then the eighth string came and I was like, I wasn't expecting to actually be way more enamored with it. But
So
I've been playing the shit out of the eighth string. And it's actually inspired me to, I'm, you know, I've said this before, and I've, cause I've had all the, and I have all these demos and all these music that I've created over the last few years, but I really like feel like in this moment that I'm creating in like a guitar instrumental EP right now, finally.
Nice.
And it's based off of this guitar just being so, so much fun to play. And
nice. So some eight-string action.
Yeah, but I'm taking a different approach, though. I'm not trying to... I mean, it'll have, like, some playing on it, but, like, my producer, I'm doing a hip-hop project on the side, too, and so I just finished up a second EP in the hip-hop thing, which I'm super excited. It's more experimental. It's more...
Nice.
Whatever.
I heard the first one. and I heard it once, so I can't tell much about it. I heard it as soon as you sent it to me. I think I heard it like next morning on my morning walk.
Cool.
As far as I remember, I might be completely wrong, and I'm sorry about it, but there were some like were it like some science fiction-y type lyrics, or more like a Buddhism related type lyrics.
Definitely.
I can't remember, but I remember it left that kind of a vibe to me.
That's good. Yeah, that's, I mean, it's just me being playing. I'm just a 40 something year old white guy in Northern California that doesn't live in the ghetto. Doesn't, you know, I'm not trying to appropriate the music. I'm not like, I'm just having fun because it's like, I love hip hop and I love rhyming to the beat and I love so many different kinds. I love where a lot of the indie hip hop people have taken the form, uh-huh. where it's a lot of more storytelling and just being themselves, you know, and getting outside of some of maybe the more traditional themes, you know, a little bit, but still playing with the traditional theme and the form in a way. The next one is going to be even more science fiction. It's all about space. It's all about, the first one is kind of just an introduction. It's just like me and I'm just like getting it out there and getting started. The second one is another three songs and it's, the color is red. The first one was blue. The color is red. This one's like darker, exploring ego and anxiety and, you know, screwing up and not being, super cognizant while still like having a thread of light in it. But like one song is all about the void and aloneness and I don't know. It's hard to explain. Yeah, I'll just send it to you when it's done, but
it's
out. But I'll listen. Trying to make a video for that stuff, you know. Nice. But in the process of doing those hip hop EPs and finishing this last one, my producer that helped me finish this one was here for a couple of weeks when these guitars showed up. And I was like, oh, I'm gonna go play this 8-string. And he was like, yeah, man, go take a break. So I was taking a break. And I don't know if you know who J Dilla is. J Dilla is like the one of the biggest, he passed on years back, but he's maybe the most important hip hop producer like of all time, like J Dilla. He created these like kind of slumpy beats, like where they swing more than they're not, you know, they have this cool swing to them and he'll put little claps like that happen early that make the snare sound like it's late, but it's not. And like, he does all these cool little things. And when I came in to just kind of play around and just start a track with the first 8-string thing, I pulled up my hip hop pack from Tune Track and I was like, oh, I'll just, they got a couple of J Dilla style beats in there. And I was like, oh, nice. Cool. Pull a J Dilla beat in and started messing around. It just started coming together really quick. And I was like, wow, I really like what's happening here. And I was like, oh, this is, wait, I'm making Diligent right now.
Diligent.
So I was like, okay, maybe that's a theme. And so I crack myself up like that and I'm having fun. I'm like, okay, just keep going.
Yeah.
So,
nice.
Now I've got like 6 tracks that are all Diligent tracks.
6 tracks already.
Yeah, already. Like, and it happened in less than a couple of weeks. Every day I come in here and I open it up and I'm like, I go through the tracks one by one. I'm like, listen. I'm like, oh, do I have something to add to this one today? Oh, yeah, I'm going to put a little thing right there. And then I close that track, open up the next one. And I go through all the tracks and see if there's something that wants to be added to that track. And I've just been using the 8-string for that the whole time. So
nice.
We'll see where it goes. It's weird talking about something before you have it totally sorted out, but whatever, you know, like,
but it's
the sun's going to explode anyway. So whatever.
Yes, to go back to that.
What about you and projects? I mean, I know that, that Below 4 is the thing, but like, do you have any other little side things that have been kind of creeping their way in creatively?
Oh yeah, all the mention? Time.
Yeah.
All the time, yeah. Well, apart from sorting out all the tab books and all that stuff. I'm right now I'm recording keyboards for Nick Johnston's new record.
Oh, yeah, awesome.
So I started working on that yesterday, and today I'm on the song number 3, and it's just, it's a blast. I love it. Yeah.
Wow.
So that's happening right now. As soon as I'm done with that, I'm going to go back to wrapping up the Below stuff, because everything else is pretty much done. I did some stuff with Vladimir for his Organized Chaos project. Also some keyboards and some arrangement stuff. I also did some more string arrangements for Nick last year. Just stuff like that. Just, you know, some guest solos here and there. And yeah, just writing Below 4. There's so much. I wrote so much music. It's actually kind of weird. I don't know what to do with all that at this point. I know a couple of songs that will definitely go. They have to go onto the record. But then I was just writing and writing and writing, and now I have to sit down and sort everything out. I have plans for, you know, a few more EPs at this point, because some of the songs that definitely don't fit the Below 4 stuff will definitely fit into something different. So there's that, and then there's plans to do a fully orchestrational EP, just orchestrations and piano, and just be like, just write everything down, kind of in the style like Everything's Fine from Below 3, the opening track.
Amazing.
And that kind of stuff. I really want to dedicate at least some time next year or the year after that to that, just writing down orchestrations and recording a live orchestra and all that. So I think that's going to be a really, really, really fun project. But yeah,
that's so exciting.
Yeah, just a bunch of ideas, a bunch of plans. Sometimes I'm thinking, like, when I look at my to-do list, because like I have like my regular to-do list, like, oh, you have to send papers to DHL, you have to do this, you have to do that. And then I have like a big projects to-do list or whatever, like ideas. And I'm like, oh my God, like I have pretty much 3 or 4 years here, 5 years maybe sorted out. Like I got stuff to work on. Yeah. So it's kind of intimidating, and it can be like, oh, I'm just not going to work today on anything, I guess, because I look at this list and I'm like, I'd rather just, you know, sleep through my day for a change. And yeah, sometimes that happens, but most of the time it's just like, I'm lucky that Jelka is such a hard worker. I mean, if I, like, as soon as I see her work, I just feel like an idiot for not working. And I would just like be like, okay, I'll be back tonight. I go to my workspace and I work. So yeah, a bunch of ideas, a bunch of stuff, but there's definitely going to be things that are going to stand in the way. Tours, hopefully, when that comes back. Obviously, whatever it is I'm working at the moment, maybe I'll have some completely different plans in a year. Who knows? Maybe I'll be like, fuck the orchestra EP. Like, the hell am I thinking about? Like, just like trying to get the entire orchestra together and all that. But then again, it's something I've been thinking about for years now, and I feel like it needs to be done.
I hope that you don't say fuck that orchestra EP, because
yeah,
that,
I hope so as well.
Man, like that's one of the more defining elements of your music. I mean, you have so many beautiful things that you brought in that now define like what your music sounds like in a way. But again, I go back to like, I label it as an appreciation for space and timing and phrasing and all that stuff. But really it's like, I mean, maybe you would just call it orchestration or whatever, but like the fact that you take the time to build a theme so long before you even get to like a guitar riff or a, you know, like I'm like, it really pulls you in, and it feels in some ways a little bit like a scoring, like a, like a score to, like the soundtrack to something. It's almost like you're wanting to pull the listener in. And like, I mean, we always like, bro, we're like, oh, that album is the soundtrack to this part of my life, you know, like we'll say that type of thing. But I don't know, is that ever crossed your mind around it be kind of being a score or a soundtrack to?
Absolutely. Because I do have background in film scoring and all that. So before I released Pillow One, I was, even in my primary school, I really don't like talking about this, but it's kind of true. Like I was considered like a prodigy child or whatever. Because even some newspaper wrote about me, because this huge composer from Serbia, Kornelije Kovac, he was introduced to my music when I was 13. And he immediately wrote an article about it in some music paper here in Serbia. It was called like something like Light at the End of the Tunnel. And then it was more music theory focused, the whole article. But then he was, you know, telling people about me, how I'm 13 years old and I can do all this stuff and all that. And he mentioned me on the TV. And then I quickly got in touch with a bunch of people from music industry here. Like by the age of 15, I was pretty much in there. And I was working with a bunch of people on some TV shows, on some theater stuff. And then, you know, I guess somewhere along the line, I realized that there's not much money to be made in that. And then some other things got started in getting involved, like just writing, you know, arrangements and doing all that kind of stuff for like some pop singers. And then I quickly got sick of that. And then Berkeley came along, and then I came back from Berkeley. I realized there's no going back to Berkeley because there's no money. And yeah, long story short, I released Below One as a result of a deep, deep depression. And I released it for free. I was like, ah, here's something. I didn't even name the songs. When I looked at my project files, when I started doing the remasters for Below One and Two and Three, I saw that I had the song names for the Below One. It wasn't like Below Part One, Part Two, Part Three. They have actual names. And I was like, why did I not use this? And then I remembered, I just wanted to release that sort of kind of as a demo, I guess, just like be like, oh, this is what I do. If someone cares, please, you know, I guess follow me. And then I just released it through Mediafire, which is, you can hardly call that a release. It's like a file sharing platform. I was like, oh, here's my EP.
Sure.
Just download it. And yeah, I guess that's how it started. But yeah, definitely before that, I had, you know, a bunch of experience with writing for theater and some TV shows, just like doing orchestrations for, even for those pop singers, they required some orchestral stuff. I also did one movie. It was a movie with Christian Slater and Donald Sutherland in it.
Really?
Yeah, it's called Assassin's Bullet. And recently I watched it with my friends on Discord together, because I never watched it. I just did the music for it and I never touched it. Like even my dad, like as soon as it came out, he found like a pirated copy CD on the street market. And he was like, oh, look what I found. And it was just sitting on the shelf for years and I never watched it. And then someone decided to download it and be like, okay, let's make like a watch party on Discord. It's not a good quality movie. It was like one of those B rated movies that had good actors in it somehow.
Sure.
But it was just fun to see that and to hear the the score on that. I was sharing the score with one more guy. I forget his name, but it was like a 50-50 split of the credit and all that. But yeah,
wow.
a bunch of that, definitely in my past. Up until 2015, I was working on other people's projects. And then I was like, I can't do this no more. And I needed to prove to myself, and I needed to prove to my parents as well, because they were, you know, as any other parent, they're worried for my, you know, financial stability and future.
Mm-hmm.
So when I released, when 2015 came, I remember like my New Year's resolution was to not work for anyone else anymore. And I told everyone not to call me, that I'm not working this year for anyone else. And then I released Ego and Eco in August, September, maybe that year. I don't remember exactly, but then I saw that it could be done actually financially. You could have like a pretty normal life, stable life in that sense, and just do crazy stuff with your music, do whatever it is that you feel like doing pretty much.
You're one of the people that has, like, when I think about releasing music in the modern age, you're one of the few people that I feel like a lot of artists should look to, honestly, like in the way. And I'd like to hear more about your philosophy around releasing music, because from the outside looking in, I remember first coming into awareness of Below 3 was really where my introduction to your music. And then I went backward and then was there for Ego and Eco and all this other goodness that you've been releasing. But what I had noticed was that you predominantly would, like, you put it up a full stream on YouTube, which would be, you know, obviously no charge, and then do a Bandcamp, and oftentimes you're like, pay what you want.
Yeah.
And I was like, I just remember you were like the first person first artist that I ever saw do that. And I was like, well, that makes a lot of sense. Like, if the mute to me, because that's putting a lot of trust and faith in the work that you've done, saying, look, and you can pay what you want. I want you to hear it. I want you to experience the music. That that was the message I got, was that it's more important for you to be heard and for you to experience the music than it is for me to get money from it.
Yeah.
Necessarily. Right. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. And that, I mean, that also comes back to the thing we mentioned at the beginning, that, you know, a couple of colleagues of mine and guys that, you know, work around me and Pliny and a few other guys, that's what they've been giving me shit about in a way. Not in a bad way. I mean, I know what they mean by being like that. And I know that they honestly worry, but there's really not much to worry about. I don't know what the right word is for that, but they, you know, care, I guess. They care.
Sure.
Because, I mean, obviously, my financial stability also, you know, means their financial stability in a sense, at least a percentage of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes sense, you know, and also they want to see me happy. Let's put it that way. So when I released Below 1, as I said, I just put it up on Mediafire, and I was like, okay, here's some music, hope you like it. And then I remember guys from Monuments shared it. They were signed for Century Media at the time, and then when they shared it, and when Euroblast guys shared it. Euroblast is a festival here in Europe that kind of put gents on a map of live shows in a way. So many bands came out of that festival. And the organizers of the festival called me and they were like, okay, do you want to perform all your stuff on our festival? Just be like opener or something. I had no band at the time. I had the idea of a band with Alexandra Jelmosh at the time.
Mm.
And I was like, to prepare below one and play at the festival would probably be a stretch. And but I didn't tell them that. I was like, oh yeah, that's all cool. But I have this really cool band called Destiny Potato. Maybe, you know, maybe, you know, we can do a show there. That would be more, much easier for me. We didn't have songs. We didn't have enough songs. We didn't have any band members. We didn't have anything. They were like, sure, let's do Destiny Potato opening Euroblast 2011. And I was like, cool. I got to tell Jelmers about this. And then I told her, and then I broke up with my girlfriend at the time, who was a singer in a band, because just things didn't work out, I guess, between us. And if I wanted the band to be a serious thing, I needed to, you know, wrap those things up, see, you know, if there's anything that we can do about the relationship. But it ended up, you know, breaking up. And then we found a second singer really quickly. Then, you know, just like find a bass player really quickly, write a bunch of songs, here's the songs, practice the songs, played live on the festival. And Century Media guys heard us and they approached me on that festival. And they were like, expect a deal coming to you in a few days. So we went through all that stuff with Century Media, and then we canceled the contract last minute because Century Media, we knew at the time because we had insights that Century Media is going bankrupt, which happened maybe 1 year or 2 years down after that, after we canceled the contract. And yeah, just a bunch of things happened. In the meantime, I released Below 2, also put it up, like, whatever, here's stuff. And then I was working on Below 3 immediately. Below 3 for me was a cleansing period from everything that happened in that period, from Below 1 and Euroblast and Century Media and Below 2 and releasing, actually working on Destiny Potato stuff, which was pretty... It was all a bit much. And I started drinking as well. I developed a bad habit with that for a bit. And then my liver suffered. They said that my liver is like 7 centimeters bigger than it's supposed to be. And that it's kind of dangerous. And when that happened, kind of at the time when that happened, I started working on Below 3. So I went on a huge, long diet. I lost like 10 kilos, which is maybe 20 pounds or something like that. Got my shit together. I didn't have a girlfriend for a while. I was just like listening to music, making music, sleeping on a little floor mattress, just waking up, working on some more music, sleeping on the floor mattress every day. Just inviting people over, recording like a little choir, like recording Alex, recording Lalic, recording whoever. And that's pretty much how Below 3 came by. It was just a long therapy session, like almost a year long, pretty much. And that was the result. And it still feels like a result of that. It helped me put my name on the map in a way and helped me put my shit together. Yeah.
So was it, do you feel like it was an intentional, I mean, on some level it must have been, but was it an intentional tactic to put the music out there as kind of like free, pay what you want type of thing, and just to like to kind of arrive on the scene with that Below 3.0, or was it kind of less intentional?
I don't know. I just never really cared about the money aspect of it. Don't get me wrong. I love money. That's not the problem. Like I see its place, definitely. Mm-hmm. I guess I don't love it enough to be like super businessy about my shit. So I always approach... Yeah, I guess I always approach things a bit more personally. both songwriting and releasing the stuff, like every time I hit that share button, I just probably spend the next half an hour crying like an idiot. Yeah, like every time really? I release music, yeah. Every time I release music, I would just like click the share button and then just wow, waterfalls. And Jelka was witnessing that with the release of Ego and Eco. My parents witnessed that with the release of Everything Before That. And same with the Who Beat the Moon. Not necessarily Destiny Potato stuff and Sordid Pink stuff, because there's, you know, more people involved and it's not too personal. But when it comes to my own stuff, it's always really, really, really personal. And it's just, it's very uplifting, not uplifting. It's just like a huge, huge, I'm just translating Serbian sayings in my head into English, but nothing works. It's just
like a birth of sorts, like when you're crying, like some people say, oh, I birthed this, like I gave birth to a project, or is it something different?
Not necessarily, but it just feels like a weight's been lifted off my shoulder. I guess that's the saying in English. A huge weight, like everything you experience, you just gather everything, you put it into, you know, your musical piece, and it just filters out, and you can be, you know, a normal human being. Like it's much easier that way, I guess. So yeah, I never really looked at my music as a way of earning money, I guess. It's never been that. It became a part of it, obviously. And it's probably gonna become a bigger part of it as time progresses, but I never wanna lose that, you know, feeling of having something to say, not just for the sake of releasing a record, but for the sake of, you know, saying what I need to say. So yeah, it's always been that. And now that I received some critics, I need to put my shit together and release some vinyls, CDs, t-shirts, all that shit.
Yeah.
And I honestly still don't really care about that much. But I know a bunch of people who follow me do, so I might as well do it. And, you know, maybe my future child will be, you know, thankful for it.
Yeah. Oh, I love, one of the things I've probably mentioned it before, but one of my favorite things is that I learned the phrase music for music's sake when I was in a classical music theory class. That was something that came up in the beginning, or as a classical music appreciation class or something like that I took in school. And I did a couple years of music program in college, and I really loved that. It resonated with me when I heard the teacher say it, and she wrote it on the board, and I was like, there's people out there that just make music just because music needs to be made, because they have a compulsion, a compelling, you know, feeling within them to do it. And to hear that was some kind of concept back in the day, you know? And you're the only one I've ever seen in modern history, like in modern times, so to speak, that to continue to use that as kind of a slogan for, in a way, I feel like it says so much about you as a composer, is about somebody that's interested in communicating ideas and feelings to other people. Where did you pick that up, through like studying composition or composers, or where did you get that?
Not at all. I was told afterwards, maybe a few years after I started using that phrase as like a slogan of sorts for what I like to do. I heard about the you know, art history from a couple of friends of mine who were telling me that that's not a new concept, obviously. And I was sure that it was not at the time. I just didn't know the roots of the idea. Mm. I still don't know the roots, honestly.
I don't know the details either.
I never checked. But I'm sure it's an old saying, probably as old as art is. But it, I don't know, maybe at the time I felt like nobody's saying it enough. I used it because it was the only way I could describe how I felt about, you know, making music. Yeah, I don't know. I don't even know how it, you know, came to be in my
universe. But it's cool obvious. that it naturally populated in your world through your experience.
Yeah. I don't remember the moment, like when I was like, oh yeah, that would be a good slogan or whatever. It was not like a marketing shtick.
Sure.
It was just like a thing that happened, I guess, like most of the things that happen in my career.
I mean, the statement itself is kind of anti-marketing, anti-kitsch, anti-thing to me, because it, maybe not anti, but like it's devoid of. The statement itself is saying, I'm not here to make a hit single for you. I'm not necessarily here to make what I think you want to hear. Mm. I'm just trying to capture ideas that tend to flow through me. It's what it says to me, you know? So I just appreciate that there's something pure about that statement. It's something about that kind of pulls me back, and I'm like, oh yeah, it's just a good reminder. I go, oh, I don't have to do anything that is expected of me necessarily. In my world, in my creative world, right? You know, I get to be master of this domain. I get to throw paint on that wall if I want, and nothing on that wall. You know, I get to do. Yeah. This and for its own sake.
Yeah.
So
I don't know. I honestly never wanna lose that. Like I could have released Pillow 4 a million times by now, and I could have probably made money off of it and, you know, grow my name bigger or whatever.
Mm.
But I feel like there are stories that I need to tell with it still. I'm just, you know. I'm just slowly writing them down pretty much. But now that I'm thinking about it, maybe that whole feeling, because I remember when I released Below 2, I remember my mom was sitting next to me and I clicked that share button and I started crying and she was like, like it's going to be okay, whatever it is that's bothering you. And I remember waking up the next morning and there was like a couple of thousand bucks on my Bandcamp account. And it was the first time for me to see my own money made from my own music. And it was pretty shocking, honestly. And what I did for the next couple of months, I found a bunch of charities and I was just giving away 60-70% of whatever I made to the charities, because it started feeling dirty for some reason. It started feeling like really dirty. It's like this one thing, this pure thing that I've been working on since I was 12, maybe even earlier, if we count in the stuff I did like when I was 5 years old, just like recording myself on Cubase on an old Atari computer. But yeah, it's been always just like this pure filter that just is there for me to express myself. And then I put it up on sale. It was like $4 maybe, that EP, or $5. And then all of a sudden in the morning, I see money from it. And I was like, just didn't feel right. It didn't feel right at all. And it could all come back to, I guess, the way I grew up. I don't know why, but I always remember as if everyone was telling me that there's no money in music, that you never make money, just, you know, you can't sell, you know, that electric guitar to the Western people. They made it up. You can't, you know, do anything. And to me, it never was that. It was always just like, okay, but I got things that I want to say. Like, I just want to, you know, put music out, and that's all I care about. So when the time came to actually see some money attached to my music, it felt really unnatural and a bit shocking, I guess, because like, oh, okay, I guess there's people who want to buy stuff, like this weird music, whatever it is. So yeah, I couldn't get over that feeling. Eventually I did. But in the beginning it was really unnatural. That's the best way to describe it.
Well, that pretty much encapsulates it for me. I think I understand better now where you're coming from, because I have to just say thanks for being an example of that, because I just would love to see just in the world of so many people that are in the music business that we can see. I mean, most of our peers, most of our friends, most of the people that are, they're doing it for the love of the music, right? But they're, but no matter if you're doing it for the love of the music, and if it becomes a business and you've got a lot of people that have their fingers and hands in the business, they make a percentage, the more pressure there is. Right. Mm-hmm. And you're speaking to that now. You're like, I've got management. I got people that want to, you know, me to do the thing. So when you have less expectation or less involvement in some ways, and that way it helps keep things more pure to that original idea, original feeling, mm-hmm. even though you are making money off of the music. And I think that that's the kind of the relationship that I see that you have kind of cultivated or created here. In that saying, hey, you know, I'm really open-handed about it. If you just want to listen to it on YouTube, you can. Thank you for listening. It's like, I can see that in your approach. And then, but the fans love your music so much. They're like, no, let me pay you double what you're asking for it on Bandcamp. Right?
Man, okay. So I don't check my Bandcamp very often, but I remember there were people who would pay like a record that I released for like $8 on Bandcamp, people would pay like $150.
What?
Wow. Yes. And that's something I could, you know, like I would always obviously write an email saying thank you to those guys, because you get like a list of people who paid the most on your Bandcamp. Like there's like a complete list of how much people paid, and not that, you know, I don't want to undermine the people who paid less or who paid nothing, maybe when my music was free, I'm equally thankful. But, you know, if money was, an expression of gratitude, and if someone had that kind of money to express that gratitude through it, why not thank them? You know, if someone writes me a nice message, I would thank them as well, obviously. Mm. But it was just super shocking to me that there's people who will not pay just $8, but like, here's more. And people always pay more, which is also pretty crazy.
It is interesting. It's really interesting.
It's interesting, yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I'm glad that I don't know, got to inspire.
Man, you're inspiring a lot of people and myself. You're at the top of my inspirations, really, especially with, oh man, pleasure's all mine. I when I listen to how you play, and I love that you have been more subtractive. Like in some of your videos, you're like, if I play less notes, you know, I might like not have a career as a shred guitar player. You know, yeah. I love that, man, because like, I think, again, I'll go back. I think there's this, whether it's conscious or unconscious, there's an appreciation for space in what you do in your art. And it just shines forth in a way that like, when you do a fast run, when you do go in for the more technical aspect of what some, you know, is a, probably a big portion of fans that are like, oh, David's like, he's one of the shredders. He's like Pliny. He's like this, he's like that. And they come to you for that on one hand, and then they stay like, whoa, there's like all this composition that happens too. But that space and that patience that you kind of like steep your music in pays off, you know, like there's more, it makes it more impactful when you do the more technical things, is what I'm trying to say, you know. Right. So the fact that you take those times,
I agree. I agree. Not just like for myself, but music in general, I think it should be. That's right. I was watching this morning, I was watching Lord of the Rings reactions, like people reacting to Lord of the Rings. I don't know why it came up on my YouTube, and I was like, people are reacting to Lord of the Rings. Okay, let's check out. And every, you know, like I was watching that and I was kind of trying to remember the movies. They are pretty impactful movies, obviously. And just thinking about it, you see people cry, you see people get angry, you see people get, you know, touched by the, you know, courage of those warriors or whatever, you know. It's like, it's a really, really cool concept. But then I start thinking about the movie. It was always ups and downs. Like you get this huge battle, this craziness, and then it's not followed by, you know, a little less craziness. It's followed by some peaceful environment, be it like just, you know, Bilbo Baggins and whoever, just, you know, being on a tree that walks around, you know, just like you hear birds and the deep tree voice, and then it goes back to the battle all of a sudden. You know, people are just killing each other, heads are flying or whatever. And that's always how I imagined music. Like it cannot be, you know, on 11 all the time, or like 4 for the entire song, or I don't know. If I always felt like, and that's something my dad used to tell me, because he's a musician himself, he's like, he would always listen to music with me, and especially classical music or some more like world music type stuff. When we listen to it, he would be like, oh, you hear how he, you know, he made everything grow so, so big, and then he just took it all away. Mm. Like, you see how much that impact left on you, leaves on you, and then he would play it again, and I'll be like, oh, wow, like, that blows my mind. And I guess I just started implementing that kind of philosophy into my writing subconsciously. It's just something I grew up with, I guess, just listening to a bunch of world music, classical music, that kind of stuff. I think that makes sense. It's not something I think about often, but you know, now that we have a chance to talk, it's kind of coming back, I guess. Which is nice.
I'm thankful for your dad, man. Your dad obviously, you know, shaped a chunk of how you see music, right? So
he's amazing. He's been cool. The biggest support in all of this, like from when I was little, when I, you know, he was a drummer. He was actually a pretty famous drummer in the 70s in some rock bands. Wow. And then he used to live in Vienna. He was playing in some jazz rock bands, stuff like that. And then when my sister was born, he stopped playing. He wanted to take his time with the family. He wanted to put his time into a family, and started a bunch of businesses and kind of drifted away from music. But I was born 9 years after her, and I guess that was his chance to stay connected to that world in a way. So, you know, even today, still, he's my biggest critic and biggest support. My mom as well, with him, obviously, although she's the biggest support. She's not that much of a critic. But yeah, he can both be harsh and really, really supportive at the same time, which puts things in perspective, which I think it's important sometimes. Obviously.
Yeah, we need that. We need somebody that has an objective eye, objective ear in our, and hopefully we have a couple of them in our lives, right? Like, if everybody is all support all the time, then you're just going to think your shit is awesome and nothing stinks, right? Like,
yeah.
But if you've got a couple of good trusted people, they're like, I mean, good idea, but maybe a little to the left, to the right. Yeah, I don't know. Like something's not quite, you know, think about it again before you push share, you know, think about it one more time.
And you know, what's funny, like he would say something like that, like, oh, I can't hear much of that little chimey thing that you're trying to put in the background or whatever, like little detail. He's like, I can't hear it. Why did you put it in there? I can't hear it. I'm like, you know what? Fuck you. Like, what do you know? When was the last time you wrote something? And then he would be like, I would be like, wow. He would leave the room and I would be like, okay, fuck off. I would chill for 10 minutes. I would be like, oh, he's fucking right. I can't hear the chime. I can't hear the fucking chime. Yeah. And that's... I would fix it. I would never tell him. I would be like, oh, he'll probably hear it. Who gives a shit?
That's hilarious. That is a classic case. I go through that. I love that process. I don't love it in the moment, but I love that process when I recognize when somebody gives me feedback, because it's that ego part that goes, who are you? Why are you questioning me? This is my shit. This is my playground. I do what the fuck I want. And then when you soften just enough and you stop being in reaction and you actually consider the feedback and you're like, oh wow, like actually that, okay, like I kind of, you know, all right, cool, well you're co-producer now, you know, like I'm gonna switch it, I'm gonna change it, you know, whatever it is. It's a good feeling actually to be, I like the term of being co-written by other people, right? Like, so not just in music, but in life. Like when, you know, there's been moments in my life where I got feedback. I remember I got feedback from my grandmother when I was in my 20s and I was running around doing stupid shit and didn't have money to feed myself. Multiple months in a row, and I would call her up and be like, hey, can you bring me some money or some food again? And like the third month in a row, she was like, all right, you know, I'm doing this because I love you, but I want you to know that I'm not going to be here. You should know that I'm not going to be here forever, and I can't keep doing it. Like, you've got to figure it out. And it was there was a point of you know, I didn't like hearing that at all. It wasn't comfortable, but it was the necessary thing that needed to be said. And I'm so, so thankful. I'm like, thank you for speaking up and telling me that my shit stinks. Yeah. Like, cause otherwise I wouldn't know. And I wouldn't grow. You know? Yeah. So
that's right.
That's good.
Yeah. It's probably a part of a reason why I like speaking with people who don't necessarily agree with everything I stand for, which my dad is a person like that often, you know. Like we would start some really heavy topics, like as heavy as they go. Death, racism, politics, like genocides, history, whatever. And we would not necessarily agree on some stuff, like some minor stuff, some minor differences, but you know, I love putting things in perspective. Like I remember I was so sure that I could have a band and have everyone, you know, that was the idea at the time, at least. I was like, okay, I'm going to make all the music, at least for the first two or three records. Everyone can get, you know, equal pay. I don't give a shit. I just want to, you know, make this project work and then we'll figure it out. Like who's going to write what and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I was telling that to my dad, and he was like, that's not going to work. That shit sucks. We tried that with communism in our country. It didn't work. And I was like, you know nothing. Like, times have changed, whatever. And a few years later, you realize that not everyone appreciates the work you've put into, you know, that stuff. And then things kind of fall apart, I guess. And then, you know, you learn a lesson, I guess, a hard way. But there, you know, like those kind of things leave a mark for sure. Those little conversations, like, I remember it like this day. I was standing in the hallway and we were talking about that shit. And a few years later, he never said, you know, I told you so. But, you know, it's pretty much obvious what happened.
You know? Right, right. It's difficult.
It's not easy. Definitely not easy. Yeah. That's why it's just Alex and me right now. Because mm-hmm, I know how to write and live with her. It's like, we're cool. We've been doing this since we were 16, so it's fine. Like, it's pretty natural. And we have some, you know, some things we don't agree on necessarily a bunch of times, but it's just a part of what we are and who we are. I mean, he will change some stances, I will change some stances and stuff, and we grow. But yeah, when you know someone for such a long time, it's I feel like it's much easier. It's much easier to communicate, say things, be honest. Yeah.
That's great. But
again, we have Sibe and we have Arno who are playing drums and bass. Not officially a part of the band, but, you know, we love to have them around. Like, whenever the tour happens, you know, they're going to say their price and we're going to take them with us, I hope.
Amazing.
If everyone is, you know, up for it. But yeah, for now, I want to keep it strictly Alex and me. It just makes sense. And yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
I wonder, I should start to wrap it up a little bit, just so it's not like a 3 or 4 hour thing, but because I feel like we could definitely do that.
Yeah.
I'm curious, two things, and take your time responding, but what have you shifted what picks you're using at all? And so can you share what you're using now? And so, also, okay, maybe you could share, post that, what music you've been listening to. If you know, is there any artists or any composers or anything that you might be able to turn us on to?
Picks. I have two picks on my table right now, so I guess those are the ones that I'm using.
Yeah,
that's as easy as it goes. So I have this one. I've been using it for quite some time, I think. I don't know. Pliny's actually a person that got me onto this. It's a prime tone. Sorry, I'm completely illiterate when it comes to this. Primetone 1.4 downloop black.
Oh, it's a Jazz 3XL?
It's a Jazz 3, but it's that brown one. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Like semi-transparent, that's nice, brown thing. I love those with a grip. I don't know for what reason. It's just, I don't know. Yeah. I didn't have my own picks on that tour, so I was stealing Pliny's picks and I just got used to them, I guess. And then I have the same thing, but smaller. Yeah. Same thing, but smaller. Also 1.4, but it's like a small version.
Oh, yeah. The regular size Jazz 3.
Oh, that's the regular, right?
Yeah.
For me, this is the small and that's the regular.
Yeah.
Because that's the first size peak I ever got into.
I see.
But yeah, obviously that's the XL and this is the regular. But those are the two. I just like the grip. I also have this red one, little red one.
Oh yeah. That's the classic Jazz 3. Yeah.
Yes. I like that one. How much is that? Is it 1.4 as well?
Those ones usually are 1.35 or probably like 1.35, almost close to 1.4.
Right. Yeah. it's just trees for me. And fun enough, I still have my, I think I told you this, I still have my first ever guitar pick saved.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I've saved it. I put it in my, you know, like that little SD card, like a
the case,
little case, like a white case, yeah, or whatever. So I've put my first pick into that like little case, and I've put it like at the back, in the back of the drawer somewhere, and I know it's there. But yeah, that's my first pick. It's all muddy and it's worn out completely, but it's like, that's my first pick. It was a Jazz Tree XL, the red one. Yeah, the classic.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's super cool.
Yeah, that's the pick that my guitar teacher gave to me. And it's probably not the first pick I held in my hand, but it's the first pick I started playing with, actually. Mm. Because until then it was like whatever. Like we had some pick lying around that wasn't even branded or whatever. It was just like learning chords. And then my first guitar class when I was 14 or 15, I don't remember, but yeah, I was like, this is the pick. You're going to play with this pick. And I was like, okay, I guess that's it. Never changed. Never changed until today. Yeah.
Wow. I love that. That's great. It's probably very, very few guitar players in the world can say they have their very first, you know, official guitar pick that was theirs.
Yeah, I'm aware.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah, we've lost all of them. They're all in some nether realm.
Incredible. Yeah. How easily they disappear.
It's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so what have you been listening to? What's the vibes there? Do you listen to much music while you're in the throes of creativity, being creative, or do you kind of have to shut off music? And
it goes while both you're... ways. Kinda. I know that. So right now I'm in a position where I can't wait to get back to writing Below 4, actually recording Below 4, because I wrote so much. And listening to music just makes me too excited to go back to writing. And I have other shit to do, and I completely avoid it, honestly. Because like I would listen to something cool and I would be like, I could not stop thinking about what I'm going to do next, music wise. Just cannot stop thinking all day. I'm just lost, completely lost.
Mm.
I just need like a little spark to happen and I'm gone. And so I'm avoiding listening to like, I'm just avoiding listening to music altogether pretty much. But when I do listen to music, I'm probably, I'm either, you know, listening to Tame Impala.
Mm.
I've been getting really into them lately.
Great band.
I love them, absolutely. Like, especially during the lockdown. So a few things that saved me during the lockdown, actually during the lockdown, as we had a serious lockdown here, we did not. But, you know, like during this whole thing, so first of all, like Bella and Jelka, they've been a blessing, obviously. And then drugs, of course. Just, you know, something here and there. It's nice. Get relaxed. Actually, you're the one who hooked me onto edibles. Yeah. Okay. I remember. So we were at NAMM, obviously, and I came by the Kiesel stand, and you were like, oh, it's a gummy, whatever. And I was like, oh, nice. And you were like, it's an edible. I had no idea. I think it was like 5 milligrams or something.
Yeah, something small.
For my brain, that was 15 milligrams probably, because I've never smoked weed. I've never touched anything up until that point.
Mm.
So, yeah, that was my getaway drug. Yeah. Yeah. Needless to say, we were pretty much high for the entire of that California trip afterwards. People just bought a bunch of edibles. So it was It was Pliny, Simon, me, Chris. I always want to call him Chase. That's a funny story. Troy, Pliny's girlfriend at the time, we had this California road trip. We went to Joshua's Tree. We went to Death Valley. We went to a few other places, like in the mountains for a few days. And we were just, you know, enjoying nature and, you know, having laughs. Oh, Raul was there as well, our marketing guy. It was probably one of the most beautiful experiences of my life, honestly. Those people, that ambience, it was perfect for a week just traveling through deserts and mountains. Absolutely beautiful. And yeah, been enjoying edibles ever since.
Amazing. Yeah. I'm glad to be the guy that kicked it off for you. I'm pretty sure I kicked it off for Andy James too. Oh really? He came to hang out at my house in LA, and way before that was when he came to do EMG TV or something like that, and he came over to the house. I might have made him smoke a little bit, or maybe it was secondhand, or made him, I don't know. He ingested some sort of cannabis, and then he went, I handed him the guitar, and he just, I think it was his first time really ever having like a moment with cannabis. And half an hour later, he looks up and he's like, "The guitar feels so amazing, mate." Like, it was just like, and he was just blight. He was already such a shredder, but for him to like be like in this kind of super state, he was like so excited about it.
But, that's amazing. Yo, you know what? Yeah. Didn't slow him down. Slowed me down for sure.
Awesome. I'm the reason you're playing less and less notes. I get there
you
it. Go.
Yeah, thank you for that.
That's cool.
I'm playing less and less, but I'm enjoying them more, I guess.
Yeah.
That's what matters. But yeah, jokes aside, it should be taken responsibly.
Of course, we
take it sometimes, but I think it's I think it's an important plant for sure. Like, my dad can't sleep without it. It helped me and Jelka obviously throughout the whole COVID situation, just keep us chill, keep us focused even. Unfortunately, it's not something that's legal in Serbia, but you know, everyone gets it somehow. So it's like, I think it's really healthy. It also builds some healthy habits. We do longer walks for whatever reason. just enjoying nature, I guess. It's a bit different, but it's nice. It's a nice state of mind, I would say. Not necessarily, it's definitely not better than being in the moment, here and now, but it's different, I guess. It's different. It's nice. Yeah.
Agreed. I don't think it's better, even though I enjoy it a lot. Yeah. it's not something that it's one of the few refuges, like in a way, like for an artist or a creative person. And not everybody can handle it the same way, right? So some people have different experiences. You know, they don't feel super chill. They get anxious and they get anxiety. Mm-hmm. And I'm so thankful I'm not one of those people. I get such an expansive, calm, big thumbs up kind of feeling. And like you said, oftentimes it helps me focus. But you use it too much and it doesn't work the same way.
Yeah, you know? definitely. And we've been there, I think.
Definitely been there.
You become useless pretty much, and you don't want to do that. Yeah.
No. Well, you were going to tell us when you do listen to music, what maybe some things that you might suggest for other people to listen to, even though you're not listening to it right now.
Yeah. So Tame Impala is definitely the one, although they're crazy popular right now. So
sure.
I'm pretty sure most people know who they are. I was always a huge, huge, huge fan of Mute Math. I think they're one of the more important bands in the alternative rock pop scene, call it whatever. For me, at least, they are like one of the top five bands for sure.
Super good band.
Yeah, I love them. So they are always like a safe space for me, for my brain. What else? I've been getting into, like, I can't really listen to much progressive metal stuff. But I've been really digging is Humanity's Last Breath.
I absolutely
love their stuff. I even ordered my first vinyl ever.
Really?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Humanity's Last Breath.
Yes. They're from Sweden, I believe. And it's very, very extreme. Kind of, I don't know if you've heard of Viljarta in the past.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's one of the guys that used to be with Viljarta, or maybe a few of the guys that used to
be
with Viljarta. So it's that kind of, extremism.
Got it. Yeah.
But it's very extreme. Yeah, but it's a bit more refined, I would say. And it's just kind of cool. I don't know. I like it. I like the... It's super wild. That's it. I don't know. And for whatever reason, it's very soothing in a weird way. Like, I can listen it to, when I'm taking a walk, when I'm in nature, when I'm, walking through the city, when I'm driving. It doesn't matter. Like, it's soothing in every situation. It's that extreme. Like, they've made full circle in a way and came back from behind and are like, yeah, I guess we are here. And we fit. So, yeah, I kind of like them. I really appreciate what they do with their, stuff. That's pretty much it when it comes to metal and guitars, because those guitars almost don't sound like guitars. But, yeah. I don't know what else. I guess I just don't listen to music that much at the moment. It just gets me,
as
I said, gets me super excited to work on my own shit.
That's actually the thing that's a reoccurring theme that I keep finding out with folks that are, especially people like yourself that kind of compose the vast majority or the entirety of their music, that because you're, the senses are so heightened in you in a way to the melodic sense and to hearing certain hooks and stuff, that I know I keep hearing more and more that artists while I'm writing, I don't want to hear other people's stuff. I'll end up writing something like it, or it'll shift me in a direction that I'm not necessarily intending to go. So that's an interesting concept. And I, for myself, I don't think I retain things quite as easy in that way. So maybe it's easier for me to I do get inspired though. I think it's, but when you, for a person like you that can hear a melody probably and then go find it, it'll stick in your head and you probably can go find it on the piano or the guitar pretty easily. That's not something that I do. So I don't run the risk of it in the way I'm like, oh, I might end up happening upon something like that, but not, it won't plague me in the same way.
Yeah, makes sense. I don't know what it is, but about I agree completely with what you said, that sometimes the music can tilt you into a different direction while you're writing your own shit. And that happened to me numerous times, for sure. So it's kind of you avoid listening to music when you're writing music. You avoid listening to music when you're not writing music because it makes you want to write more. So you're always in this weird state of being careful, what you're going to listen to. It's not easy. It's definitely not easy. And I have not been listening to music for a long time, honestly. Like, not wow. Like I used to when I was younger. because when I was younger, I was like, I would not care if the music is going to tilt me into a different direction. I would write, guitar piece that sounds like Steve Vai, completely like Steve Vai. But for me today to write something that sounds like Steve Vai would be kind of disappointing.
Sure.
Not because Steve Vai is...
No, I get it. Because you don't want to sound like Steve Vai.
I just don't want to be that, you know. I want to develop my own stuff. But yeah, it's not easy. Definitely not easy. But when I do find something that I like, it's hard to resist, obviously. And it might influence what you write in the future. And you just have to, you know, somehow find a place for that in your own writing style, I guess.
But yeah,
that's it.
It's great. Well, man, thank you so much for sharing so much and spending so much time with me.
Honestly, I just missed this. Podcast aside. I have no idea. We started recording for the first 15, 20 minutes.
No, it's good. It means it's natural, you know?
That's good. Yeah, I was expecting you to start talking about guitars because we are obviously going to start talking about guitars as soon as we are done.
Yeah, and we can end it here soon, but and chat about other stuff.
Cool,
but I appreciate the time, and it's just so good to hear. I love hearing the stories from your childhood, and because it helps frame for me, and I know it probably helps a lot of fans to know the depth and from whence you came. And knowing about your father and knowing a little bit about the compositional stuff that you were doing prior to the Below 1.0, that's just so wonderful to me to know that stuff. So
thank you.
thank you. All right.
Well, as soon as the whole thing is done with, and I have a chance to come to United States again, we're going to talk more about all this, camera, on camera, whatever. we can just hang. That's
I'm looking forward to that.
Right. Yeah, man.
Yeah, I have an extra bedroom here. I've got extra bedroom and bathroom, extra bikes. So if you want to come up, you stay with me for as long as you like. We ride up into the canyon, go swimming, hiking, the whole deal, the whole Amazing. Northern California thing. So
yeah, that sounds
I love perfect. That.
I'll cool. need that.
Yeah. Well, we'll end it here, and then we'll move on to other things. But so thanks again, David.
Yeah, thank you, man.
Players Pick Podcast, Picks and Perspective with Chris Johnson.